Welcome to New Narrative Southeast Asia Dispatches. I'm your host, Bonibel Ramatan, Editorial Manager for New Narrative. New Narrative is a movement to democratize democracy in Southeast Asia, and this podcast is one of the ways we attempt to do just that. We've covered the political situation in Thailand before in this podcast, a constant struggle between pro-democracy factions and former royalist powers. Although there are members of the press on both sides, the idea and maintenance of press freedom itself remains a challenge, especially since the 2014 military coup. A large number of activists were detained by the military for weeks of re-education. Critics have been arrested with computer crime charges under CCA for posting comments on social media accusing government leaders of corruption. And the COVID-19 emergency decree has been abused to detain those who organized protests as recently as last month after the bans have been lifted. It's not uncommon for protesters to be beaten and shot with rubber bullets. Not all hope is lost, though. Media freedom, despite remaining a challenge, still exists to a certain degree.
Hello, so my name is Niu. I'm a Thai who lives in Bangkok. I've been a Bangkokian all my life. So since the political movement of the Rasadon, like the new Rasadon movement of 2020 started, I kind of, you know, like grabbed my camera. At that time, it was a phone camera as well. I didn't have like an actual camera like until later. So I just go out, record stuff, write about it. Like I write whatever I see, whatever I hear on Twitter, make threads about it, and you know, like a Google reference about it in order to add more context for the readers. And I've been doing that for a few years now.
That is new. A citizen journalist and pro-democracy activist who believes that there are ways to maintain your safety while still being very, very critical of the government. New is not employed by any news organizations and covers protests voluntarily. So let's hear what they have to say about Thailand's media and activism landscape, their personal experiences, how to stay safe, and of course, the kind of regional solidarity that we need for Thailand across Southeast Asia.
Thank you for being here. So I guess we can call you, it's fascinating that you are, you know, basically self-trained and, you know, a citizen journalist, which we will get to later. But for starters, to set the stage here, can you explain to the listeners what the current media landscape and the media freedom situation in Thailand is? Because we do realize that, you know, since around circa 2014, there's been a coup, and then things have changed since then. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the coup in 2014 basically put Thailand into a really, you know, code red kind of situation for press freedom. So for starter, I kind of got interested in politics because the junta under General Prayut Chan-o-sha like tried to censor the entire internet by changing the entire system into a thing called single gateway. So basically everything has to pass through a governmental check before being published online anywhere. So the single gateway was not successful, however, but people did get arrested for coming out and saying that they want a general election to happen, because after the coup, like the junta was in absolute power, so people came out, asked for elections, they got arrested. After that, the junta basically said, okay, we're gonna have a new constitution now, and after that we'll have a general election. But before that, we have to do like a national referendum, and the referendum would decide whether or not the new constitution, the current one actually, is, you know, accepted by the general public or not. And basically, you cannot protest that referendum. So they ask the public a yes or no question. But if you do any kind of like activism to raise awareness about the details in the new constitution, you could be arrested. Like there's literally a law called like a referendum act, I think it's called in English. And you would be arrested if you basically speak in public, or, you know, like try to educate people about the details of of like of the constitutional draft, which is actually public. So the information is public, but if you talk about it, especially if you criticize it, you might end up in jail. So that's basically around 2014 to 2016. And after that, we got a new constitution, the general election happened, and Prayut Chan-o-Cha won because in the new constitution, the Senate, which is entirely handpicked by the junta, can vote on the prime minister as well. So basically, the entire upper house will always be on the side of the junta, and the lower house can fight back somewhat, but like we all know, it's like a 2-1 kind of situation. So the entire upper house would always like tip the scale towards the junta. So Prayut Chan-o-Cha won the election. People call this Prayut 2. So Prayut 1 is like the military, like the 100% junta controlled government. And Prayut 2 is like a slightly democratic government controlled by Prayut Chan-o-Cha as well. Sorry about that. And after that, a lot of people came out to protest because under Prayut Chan-o-Cha, the media was not censored. It was not censored, but we cannot do anything about the government or how like the budget spending is you know, like is managed basically. Some parts of the army is put under control by the monarchy, like by orders of Prayut Chan-o-Cha, like, and some parts of like royal budget, I think it's called like royal budget. So basically Thailand used to, you know, like give the monarchy some allowance to use for, you know, whatever the monarchy wishes to do. But basically in the government run by Prayut Chan-o-Cha, like a lot of things is like transferred towards the control of the monarchy, like directly. So basically we're kind of rolling back towards absolute monarchy somewhat, and people did not like this, right? So people came out to protest and stuff like that, and like of course like Prayut Chan-o-Cha was not happy about that. Some activists were forced disappeared in Cambodia at that point. I think he's called Wan Chalom. And after that, we have the Ratsadon movement, because like they dissolved like an entire party of progressives. And yeah, I don't think the entire censorship and, you know, anti-democracy activity by the government is focused on the press. Like the press can still like go around and, you know, like report on stuff. But it is very hard for the people, or like the news that we you know publish, to affect any kind of like structural change in Thailand. So like in comparison to what's happening in Myanmar, for example, I think Thailand would be in a better shape, like even when we were under control by the junta. But again, like we can do stuff, but those stuff won't ever be enough to, you know, change anything like for real. I guess that's the situation right now. We can go into the emergency decree, which is like around like the COVID pandemic, which basically grants like any kind of government agents to, you know, arrest, to detain, and they did use the emergency decree to, you know, like start using rubber bullets and like tear gas like randomly, like basically at any point they can just do that. They can also like block any kind of like news report. They do censor that as well. They can do that, but I don't they don't do that very often. I don't know why, but yeah, like the press can still operate somewhat, but the protests are dispersed violently and very oftenly, and a lot of people are charged with this. So over like 1,000 people, still counting, by the way, even though the emergency decree is already lifted, people are still getting charged, like since like from what they did in 2020 and 2021, like just like a month ago, people are still getting charged with emergency decree. So it's like quite clear that that any kind of like political expression is not very legal in Thailand. But yeah, once again, reporting on these kind of things are like kind of still okay. I would say somewhat. The press do get shot with rubber bullets sometimes, they do get beaten sometimes, but it's mainly because the police basically, like, you know, try to hurt everyone indiscriminately. So that's why the press get attacked as well. Yeah, I think that's roughly the situation of what's going on in Thailand.
It's interesting though, because usually one of the first things that authoritarian governments do is to shut down the media, even before attacking the activists, right? But in Thailand, you have attacks. I mean, you mentioned the emergency decree, but that's just one of, like, a lot of things that can be used to, like, sue activists, right? There's the infamous Les Majestés law, there's the CCA, and there's, like, all of these things. But you also mentioned that the press and, like, even yourself as a citizen journalist can still report on these things. So do you see, is there like a specific role of, like, the press council? And also in the article you mentioned, you wear armbands to indicate that you're the press to deter being attacked, you know, stuff like that. How effective are all of these things?
A little correction there. I do not have an armband. I just, you know, go and do my things. But people can request armbands. I do not know the criteria of, like, how they, you know, like, distribute this kind of, you know, like, things. But basically, you can get those. But are they useful? Like, are they useful to people in you know, protest sites? Like, do they shield you? Do they, like, allow you exceptions in, you know, like, police crackdowns and stuff like that? I don't think they help much at all. So if, like, I do not interact with the press council, like, I don't think they interact with citizen journalists, basically. So I would, like, my comment about these kind of, like, functions to protect the press in Thailand is that they have to do a lot more, because a lot of a lot of journalists who got hurt in protest sites basically got protected, basically were protected by their own employers. So basically, it's not even about like, press freedom and, you know, right to, you know, report on like, political issues. It's just about, like, employers, you know, paying, like, basically, like, extra you know, recuperation for their own employees. So I think I think like, functions, I don't know, governmental functions or, like, officials regarding, like, press freedom in Thailand is basically non-existent right now.
Yeah, I see. And you mentioned previously, before we hit the record button earlier, you mentioned about the practices of tagging. Does that happen only to activists? Does that also happen to journalists? And maybe, yeah, just to fill in the listeners, maybe you could tell us a bit about the various taggings that the government does.
There's this Interior Defense Ministry. I don't remember, like, their exact name in English, but in Thai it's called Oromono. It's like a military related department, which acts basically as an you know, as an overarching what you call, like, operation above both the military and the police. And they do have a list of, like, journalists, politicians and activists, and basically anyone. They even have, like, the daughter of, like, an opposition politician in their list, even though she's, like, 14 years old or something at that point. And on that list, there are, you know, color codes that indicate what the military, the police, and, you know, I think the entire justice system in Thailand must do against this, like, you know, particular, you know, person. So basically red, I think, is, like, I'm not entirely like, sure about, like, about this, but you can read about it because it's been reported in the Thai parliament. So it's, all of this is, like, open data. Basically, if you tag, like, for example, red, it's like a code for, like, the police, the judge, the prosecutor to try their best to, you know, jail, to imprison this person. If it's black, for example, is like to force disappear, like to kill someone. And other than that, like Yellow, for example, is like on a watch list. So you get visits, like, for example, like there are like, you know, silent surveillance. So they'll just, you know, like silently try to collect your data, try to hack your phone, try to, you know, like track your social media, like, for example. But they also have this like, you know, bullying orders, like they'll appear at your home. They will, you know, question your relative, they'll question your children, they'll, you know, take photos of your house, they'll, you know, take photos of like your vehicle, your cars, for example, and basically harass you. Like they will survey you like openly in order to, you know, make you feel scared, make you feel uncomfortable, like, you know, doing political activities.
What has your own personal experience been? Because I'm assuming, because since you are reporting on these things and talking about this to us right now, do you think you're on the list? And maybe like, what has your experience been with all of these?
Yeah, I think I'm among like, you know, the not important list, because they do have my name. Like I went to the May Day March in 2023, so this year. And like one of my friends like leaked the police like messages, and they do have my name, they do have my full name, like, and they just report that, hey, this person is in the protest as well. So like, just FYI, because I didn't do anything on that day, I was just like walking around, but they do have my name and stuff like that. At one point I was like, you know, going around like helping a farmer's protest last year. And like the police of like the local police department, you know, came to the protest to, you know, like talk with the farmers to negotiate like where they can, you know, camp, where they can protest and stuff like that. And basically like one of the directors of that police department, you know, came to me and like, you know, say hi, like with my name. Like, so they're just like, we know who you are, we know your name, we know where you are, basically. Yeah, they're just doing harassment like this. And I'm pretty sure I'm on the list, but I'm not dangerous or important enough to, you know, like to warrant them to do anything openly. I did, you know, get an iPhone, because an iPhone can detect whether or not you're hacked by you know, like the government. An Android system cannot detect that, but an iPhone, an iOS system can detect that. So I got an iPhone after that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you're still safe, that you are, you know, despite all of the things that you're doing. But how do you feel? Do you feel scared sometimes? Do you feel like you might get suddenly classified as a more dangerous individual? Or like, yeah, how do you... Do you get anxious? How do you feel?
Well, of course, I get anxious like a lot of the times. I do try to, you know, stick to the law, because I kind of know from experience where is the line. Like, if I do not cross it, I will not get, you know, like put on into like the red list, for example. So basically I do like law petitions, I do support like whatever representatives are doing in the parliament. So basically some people will do something, and if that's kind of accepted in public, I'll try to, you know, follow them. So it's like there's this line that moves around a little bit. So basically if you comment bad things about the monarchy online, like in Facebook, for example, you get a prison sentence, like for sure, like the police will come to you at your home. But since I know that, I do not do any of that, but I do criticize like the budget. Like, for example, I'll just say like, okay, like the budget could be more efficient and, you know, beneficial to the country. And I'll say stuff like that. And that's me staying within the line. And I think I'm anxious about all of those things, because some people did get like charged with lèse-majesté for criticizing the budget, like just one person though. So there's a line. I try to, you know, not cross the line, but it's still very scary. And I did sometimes, you know, participate in protests as, what you call it, as someone making the speeches as well. So I go onto like the stage, and I do talk sometimes, like, you know, just a few times. And basically, the rule is that if you go up, you're going to get charged with at least the emergency decree. I went up once, and they didn't charge me with anything. So I was pretty lucky with that. And yeah, like, I believe they do have all the information they want to know about me. But I'm not important enough to you know, pose as a threat against, like, the government right now. So I'm fine as long as I do not cross the line, as long as I do not, you know, become a bigger threat against the government. I can still do my work.
Which is, yeah, that's also pretty fascinating. Are there other things you're doing to stay safe? Because again, you don't work under any media organization. As you mentioned earlier, you know, it's often the task of the employer of the media company to protect the journalist, right? But you are a citizen journalist who doesn't really work under any media organization, which means that if you get in trouble, there's not going to be any company or any organization who's going to swoop in to save you, to rescue you, which puts you automatically at more risk. Right. How do you mitigate these risks aside from staying within the lines? Are there, like, I don't know, are there any kind of, like, digital online habits, online hygiene habits that you practice, or like making sure your gadgets are safe, or wearing certain things to the protest, or what is it like?
I do have, like, information, like contact information with the Thai Lawyers for Human Rights, so TLHR. They're really good at their job, and if, for example, I'm charged with lèse majesté or emergency decree, they can, you know, they will always help with those cases. So I have that as a backup plan, for example. But in, you know, like, for example, like violence or like just like random harassment online, I usually just, you know, stay anonymous, basically. I think that's one of the reasons I was pretty 50-50 about it when you asked whether or not, like, I would use my name in this publication, for example. But I do use my name sometimes, so it's not like clear cut anyways. It's basically a choice of words, I think. Just don't be aggressive about it, and I think that helps quite a lot. Like, just use kind of passive language, and, you know, just like add a question mark at the end of whatever you want to say, for example. That kind of helps a lot. It works the same with how to avoid defamation law, for example. So you should not, you know, make up a lie and, you know, use that lie to attack someone, to accuse someone. But you can, you know, ask questions, for example, even though, like, the question looks like an accusation. And I think you can, you know, like, report on whatever that has already been published. Like, for example, if like the BBC Thai published something about the monarchy, like, and I can talk about the article because I'm not the one doing the statement. I'm just the one, like, talking about the statement. And I usually just talk about it from the view of, like, citizen journalists. So we'll just say, oh, the facts are these, like, the numbers are these, and this is, like, the statement made by this official spokesperson, for example. And that will help me spread awareness about political issues in Thailand, but it would not, you know, like, land me in any kind of, like, danger. So a lot of it is, you know, experience how to avoid getting prosecuted by the Thai state, but while also being active in the political scene.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty smart, pretty fascinating, and pretty smart the way that you go about these things. But I have to wonder, though, you did mention that, you know, you first got interested into politics after the Thai coup of, like, 2014. And so, and you've been doing this for a while, right? You've had your experience, you've been a citizen journalist, but without being employed by any media organization, and with all of these risks that you're taking, I have to ask, What keeps you going? Why do you still keep doing this? What makes you get up in the morning and just say, yeah, I want to keep doing this. I want to keep fighting for democracy, fighting for the betterment of this situation in Thailand, despite all of the risks?
It's mostly, it's just like, well, one thing, I'm a very stubborn person. So if something that I feel is important and must be done, I will actually go and do it until it is done. And I'm also I'm quite driven by empathy. So basically whenever I go out, it's just like a lot of suffering happening, basically, like people, because I usually go out with the labor movement, the farmer movement, like the peasant rights and stuff like that. So it's not entirely about the Rasadon movement. The Rasadon movement is mostly composed of like university students and like office workers and stuff like that. Like, I'm an office worker, but I usually go out with the labor movement, which is people who work in like factories, people who work in construction, migrant workers, for example. And like their every day is suffering. Like they wake up, they don't have enough money, they're in debt, and they really, really want the Thai government to work in their favor, or else they're gonna actually, you know, become homeless, or lose their lives or like their family or their house at some point. So I think it's quite important for me. I feel like I feel like all my effort should be, you know, put in service of those people, because I think I'm born with some privileges. Like I'm born into a middle class family. I go to university. I'm not indebted because of education, and I do work in a job that pays quite well. So I think that, okay, so what's next in life, right? So I think that with all these resources and time, I should, you know, use it to, you know, help other people. It kind of started as something like that. But of course, like, you can't help people by being passive. The reason people are suffering in Thailand is because they're being oppressed by the military, by the junta. So like welfare goes down, cost of living goes up, and people are suffering because of that. And whenever they go to the government to say like, hey, can you help us with these? Can you like increase the minimum wage and stuff like that? The government would, you know, deploy the police to, you know, like beat them and disperse the protests. And it became clear from that, that if I want to help people, if I want to help people with, you know, like rights to medical care, rights to food, rights to housing, the number one goal is to, you know, fight back against the junta, because they're literally like the main cause of this. And I think is the main thing that keeps me going is that people are suffering. Like now I'm in an air conditioned room, like in front of a computer, like everything is quite comfy for me. But for a lot of people, like for example, right now there's a farmer group called the Assembly of the Poor, camping out in front of the government house right now. They've been there like for over 20 days. And I think I should prioritize what they're doing instead of like what I'm feeling or what I'm doing at this point. And yeah, I think it's a lot of it is that what I do is not about me. It's about, you know, helping people, even if it's a little, if it's like just reporting about them, or because I do help with like donations, like funding, like a food run, a supply run, and stuff like that as well. I do help with that as well, and I think like everyone should, you know, help with whatever they can, basically. So it's not even about, you know, victory or like having a big success in my field of work, or having popularity or anything like that. It's just that I feel like I'm successful, like if I keep going, I think that's my victory, I guess. So I keep trying to help these people as much as possible, even though it's not a lot, but I will try to do what I can. I think that's, you know, what keeps me going.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And I'm sure the listeners can learn a lot from that, like the important work that you're doing. But I guess also one of the most fascinating things about this conversation is that, you know, from your learning from you, it's like you don't need to constantly put yourself in harm's way in order to help people, right? You don't need to criticize very blatantly. You can use certain words. You can still be, you know, you can still be on the, you know, not break the law, but still criticize the government properly. There is still press freedom in Thailand. You don't have to become an activist who would definitely go to jail. So I guess, I believe that a lot of people want to help, like a lot of people in Thailand themselves, they want to help, and they want to help these underprivileged people, marginalized people, help to make the country better for the oppressed. But I do also believe that a lot of them are scared. A lot of them are really, really afraid whether they might, their names might be on that list. They might go to prison. They might get disappeared and stuff like that. But as you mentioned earlier, you can still report on these things. You can still, you know, take more pictures, take more films and videos, and publish writings or articles, or speak up on social media regarding, yeah, social concerns, you know, politics, climate change, human rights, labor rights, whatever, like all of these things, right? So I guess my next question related to this is that if like a listener here, they want to do more, but they're still afraid, right? What are the first steps in becoming a citizen journalist? What are the first step of, you know, doing more, but still staying safe? What advice would you give people who would like to start doing these things?
I think it's also like a relationship kind of thing. So you do help people and they do remember you, and at some point later they will help you back with something else. Like right now I do have some access to information that people don't have, but it's like simply because I've helped them. Like, for example, like the labor movement kind of lacks like lack of technical expertise in, like, for example, graphic design, like social media management, for example. They're really, really good at what they do, but basically like they don't have some expertise that they need. And I do jump in. I do always jump in and help. And I gain their trust, and that's how, you know, I get access to like their statement information, like where they're gonna go, what are their demands, and that kind of helps me, you know, report a little bit faster than like the usual the formal reporters and journalists. And like, if people want to start doing this, I think you have to be in the movement first. You have to be someone that is active in the community first. So you don't just, you know, jump in and basically, hi guys, I'm a journalist and I want to, you know, like photograph some stuff. I mean, you can do that, but it's like a little bit awkward at first, I guess. So before I became like a citizen journalist, I was like, I was more like an activist. So I help with, you know, carrying stuff. I help with, you know, random stuff, basically. I help with like the medical team. I help with, you know, like carrying food and water around, for example. And I did a lot of those. And at some point, people kind of remember me and, you know, like trust me to do more. And after that, I thought that, hey, what we're lacking right now is not, you know, people carrying stuff around, because a lot of people do help out with that. We do need like people who can write, especially in English, because at some point during the Ratsadon protest, we wanted to put a lot of news into the international kind of Twitter trend, basically. And we needed a lot of like translator who can report quickly. And I started doing that. And after that, you know, I became like a citizen journalist who is trusted by some news outlets, some journalists, because sometimes I do go to some place, I take photos, I record, I write some you know, like short notes about it. Like I don't have to do an entire article, for example, and I send those to an actual journalist, like in like an official news organization, and they do use that because they know, hey, it's new, it's me, like I can be trusted, like I actually do this because I like doing this, like, and I know that, and they know that my information is like verified, for example, and I do like give my sources and stuff like that to help them with as well. So you can start by being helpful with anything. If taking photographs and videos is not your thing, it's important to, you know, find what you can do to help people. I think it's the key is just that there is a lot of like issue going on in the world. Like you can always find you can always find issue in your local communities, in your like national community. If you find it and you feel like you have an interest in it, you can always, you know, help out with anything. Read about it, talk about it, talk to your friends, talk to people about it, and at some point you gain enough experience to kind of know what you should be doing, I think. And about like safety and all that, just simply don't be in the highlight about it. Like stay in the shadows, basically. Stay in the background and don't attract too much attention. Just don't be the person who is like in the spotlight, because the police is also lazy and they will, you know, charge people who kind of, you know, present themselves as like, you know, like the leader or something like that. They are quite lazy. Like, for example, they'll charge some people over and over because they simply remember that person. like that's about it. So don't be too prominent in the scenes, and you know, try to stay safe, try to stay healthy, refreshed, try to be independent in that sense, because if you cannot take care of yourself, you cannot be you cannot help other people if you cannot take care of yourself, basically. So, you know your limits, read the situation well, don't run into scuffles, you know, look around, listen to stuff, don't put on music in protest, like, for example. Yeah, and I don't know, like, find friends, like, go with friends and, you know, help each other out. Basically, it's something that you kind of have to learn. You kind of have to learn to be politically active. You can kind of jump into it, but yeah, you just have to learn how to stay safe and, you know, stay active in the scene.
Yeah. I guess at the end of the day, if I could summarize that, it's all about building solidarity and building a network, isn't it? Because, like, you know, you. Not making it about you is very important in for the movement, but also for your own safety. So as long as you like join up with movements and, you know, prioritize the network, prioritize the solidarity, just you know, whatever it is that you can give, that you can provide, without making it so much, you know, that you are on the spotlight. I guess that should in general the way to go, right? I wanted to follow up on your statement, because earlier you mentioned that, you know, the movement needed a lot of people who could write in English or who could translate things into English for the benefit of like the international community and like the social media trends and stuff like that. So I guess my question would be, what do you expect from the international community, especially from the Southeast Asian region, right? For example, I'm recording this from Jakarta, but yeah, how, and I'm not a Thai. I'm not a Thailand citizen. I'm not residing there. So what can people from the rest of Southeast Asia, and what can the international community, international people who want to show solidarity actually do to help Thailand, actually help the situation in Thailand?
Since we're all in ASEAN, I think it's quite hard to get like ASEAN government to do the right thing, like a lot of the time. So I think the most important thing is that we need a grassroots international movement. Because it's really hard to do things within one context. Like for example, the Thai Junta emphasized a lot on nationalism. So we have to protect the country by, imprisoning activists who want to destroy our country. Like for example, they tried to chase away ILO and Amnesty International, because they're foreigners and stuff like that, even though they're all Thai employees, by the way. So a lot of these understanding, a lot of public opinions must be taken back from whatever the military teaches us in school and tells us about on the news. For example, if we like the general rule is that if we go interview some governmental government officials in the military, in the police, they're gonna say some really undemocratic things. And so we need a new narrative to for people to rally around, because the people is usually not outnumbered, not out resourced, but they're out organized. So 70 million Thais against a few 100,000 police and military, basically the people is gonna win. but the people have to be on the same page first. So I think the information is quite important, and how we process that information from a political viewpoint is also quite important. So attacking nationalism by building international solidarity between countries is quite important to unite people across country and say that, hey, the junta, which is quite nationalist and xenophobic, is pretty bad, and we can give an example of that by talking to citizens from other countries and say that, hey, we're all kind of oppressed here. We should kind of unite and, overthrow this old ideas of authoritarianism, basically. We need this solidarity to give ideas, give hope to the movement. Because if people do not have hope, if people are stuck in old ideas, in nationalist ideas, in xenophobic ideas, racist ideas, they're not gonna do anything. And that's basically the end of the movement. People have to think about new things. People have to learn about new things. People have to be able to find new perspective, what are activists in Indonesia are doing, what do they think about on a daily basis, for example. And that will give the Thai movement a lot of power to question the government as well. So I think if we do that enough times, it's gonna create this really big opposition, which is already increasing in Thailand. For example, the Future Forward, the Move Forward Party, won the most seats in the latest election, even though they got, cheated by the Senate. I think ideas and awareness are the main factors of those victories. And I think it's quite important to not only talk about internationalism, but also practice it. For example, I do participate in a lot of Myanmar protests in Bangkok against Min Aung Hlaing regime. And I think it's really, really important for us to, spend our time, our labor, and, even our money, because I do donate to the movement in Thailand, the Myanmar workers in Thailand as well, to, show solidarity that all authoritarians are bad, not like there's not a lot of difference between authoritarians in Thailand and authoritarians in Myanmar. We kind of have to fight this idea without the limits of nationalism. And I think it's like really important for us, like for everyone to practice that. Don't be afraid of people who, you know, are not from your country. Don't be afraid of people who do not speak your language, do not look like you, because in the end, they're probably being oppressed under either, you know, the military regime or, you know, like capitalist empire and or both, basically. So they probably have a lot more in common with you, you know, in comparison to, you know, like the common Thai and Prayut Chan-o-cha, for example.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. Starting with ideas, starting with narratives, and debunking the myth that, you know, the nation, like nationality and nationalism, it worked in the past for you know, to shoo away the colonizers, I suppose. But like right now, it works more to divide potential solidarity among Southeast Asians against their own government. So breaking through that and just building these, fostering these new ideas and new narratives that we need to foster solidarity across, across national boundaries to fight against common experiences of oppression across Southeast Asia. I think that's, I think that's very, very important. Okay, I guess that's a great note to end on. We've been talking for 40 minutes now, and I guess, yeah, thank you so much, Niu, for this conversation. This has been really, really, really good, really, really productive. And yeah, really enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me.
And that wraps up our discussion with Niu. It's probably pretty obvious at this point, but I really did find this discussion fascinating. There are ways to criticize the government and cover abuses by the police and military without getting yourself jailed or disappeared. This is true in Thailand, and I believe it's also true in many others, though sadly not all, parts of Southeast Asia. Which once again leads to the urgency of building regional solidarity, to learn safe but effective practices of activism and journalism from each other, and to keep putting pressure on all the powers that oppress us. There's a space for that in New Narrative, or at least we're doing our best to foster such a space. The Media Freedom in Southeast Asia project has research, features, coverages, explainers, interviews, but also a Media Freedom Network where you can participate in legal briefings, digital security trainings, and more. Find out more on newnarrative.com/mediafreedom. That's newnarrative.com/mediafreedom, all one word. My name is Bonibel Rambatan, and this has been Southeast Asia Dispatches, brought to you by New Narrative and produced by Dania Yudo. I'll see you around.